I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Between Richard Nixon and Donald Trump, U.S. Presidents 37 and 45, the links of language and temperament are getting uncannily close. Their political predicaments, too. Listen, for starters, to Mr. Nixon's name for his stalwart supporters through the Vietnam War time, and then Mr. Trump's echo.
So tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
It's a term that I haven't heard for years, but I really think it applies now more than maybe ever before. And that's the term, the silent majority. Have you all heard that? You don't hear it anymore. You don't hear it.
Then there are their views of political press and media. Nixon in 1973, Trump this week at the Coast Guard Academy.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting in 27 years of public life. When people are pounded night after night with that kind of frantic, hysteric reporting, it naturally shakes their confidence.
Look at the way I've been treated lately, especially by the media. No politician in history, and I say this with great surety, has been treated worse or more unfairly.
Trump has called the media his opposition. Nixon made them his enemies. For the benefit of Henry Kissinger and others on his staff, Nixon, inadvertently taping himself, turned his sentiments into a song. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy. The establishment is the enemy. The professors are the enemy. And never forget it. We are testing the analogies this hour, the evidence under them, and the Trump outcome that's implied. Pat Buchanan gets us started. He's not just looking at a movie he's seen before. He was a major player in the first one, writing some of Richard Nixon's most famous fighting lines. You could say Buchanan anticipated the movie playing now in his own right-wing populist America First campaigns for president in the 90s and then 2000, first as a Republican, then as an independent. I asked Pat Buchanan this week to look at the Trump White House in light of Nixon's.
There are comparisons. There is the animus towards the media and from the media as well, but there's no Vietnam War going on right now, and there's no real Cold War going on right now. And I think people are comparing, for example, the firing of FBI Director Comey with the Saturday Night Massacre, but they're really not comparable. Nixon did that in the middle of the Yom Kippur War in an international crisis where he had lost his vice president a week before. And the U.S. forces were put on heightened alert, and Soviet ships were coming into the Mediterranean, presumably with nuclear weapons on them, or so we were detecting. And in the midst of that, he had the defiance of his attorney general, who would not carry out his orders with regard to the special prosecutor. So Nixon was forced, basically, to accept the resignation of Richardson, fire Ruckelshaus, and then fire the special prosecutor.
You say forced, Pat?
Yes, he was forced by circumstances. He told me, I was in the Oval Office with him when Richardson was waiting outside to be dismissed. And Nixon told me, I can't have the Attorney General of the United States, an appointee of mine, defying me at the same time Henry Kissinger is explaining in Moscow to Brezhnev that we're not going to back down in the Suez Crisis and Yom Kippur War. He said, if I have to get a GS-7 to fire him, I'm going to do it.
Wow. Come back to the press war. Everybody was shocked when the Trump people said the press is the opposition. You remind us that the political wise man at the Washington Post said in 1969, first year in office for Nixon, the forces that broke the Johnson administration are out to break Nixon, and they might well do it. What is recurring here in the hostility? What's new? And what is this business about breaking presidents?
Chris, I think it comes out of the cultural, social, moral, political, ideological revolutions of the 1960s, which had to do with changing the morality of the country, the beliefs. And what happened was that the left wing of the Democratic Party and the intellectual and academic elite went over, if you will, to a bloodless revolution against what had existed before in America, especially the 1950s, if you will. And what happened was Nixon was slow in withdrawing from Vietnam. He had decided we had to get out. And he was too slow, and so the mass demonstrations came. And the elites, the academic and media elites, were cheering on these demonstrators, which many of whom were peaceful, 250,000, but thousands were becoming violent in Washington. And that's when I told Nixon, you know, that you're Louis XVI here. It's 1788, and you got no choice, but we're going to have to stand up and fight. And I sent him that memo, and he decided to go to the country and ask for its support on the Vietnam War. And in the famous Great Silent Majority speech of November 3rd, he did exactly that.
That was your pre-Enlightenment phase, Pat, when you loved these foreign adventures. You've had a major change of life since then. What strikes me in retrospect is that it was the Vietnam War that got Johnson. It was the Vietnam War, in a certain way, that fired up the Nixon opposition. There's some fire under Donald Trump, and I wonder what piece of imperial anxiety feeds it.
I think you're correct about the 60s. There's no question about it. But there were other things happening, too. There were the Stonewall and the gay rights uprising against the cops. You had Altamont, you had Woodstock, and all of these things occurring in 69. It was a whole general revolution. And you're right, Vietnam, anti-Vietnam was a central part of it. Now, we don't have that today. But what has happened is there's been a maturing, and frankly, the revolution has prevailed against Middle America and captured close to half of the country. In terms of elites, it's got more than half the country, academic, intellectual, media. And that elite despises Trump.
What is the real fuel inside that fight?
It's not only political, it's deeply personal. They don't like him. You know all the terms they've used about a businessman. They think he's non-intellectual in their judgment, and they don't like the arguments and issues he's raised.
Pat, diagnose the spirit in this Trump White House. You've been there. Your book reminds us that there's a kind of paranoid fungus that comes out in a White House staff under terrible pressure. What do you see in the Trump White House today?
It's hard to believe this is sustainable for 4 years when you consider that we're not quite done one-third of Trump's first year. It's becoming really a fight to the finish between the press, the media, which is the opposition party, and the President of the United States. I got into the White House, and a reporter came into me who traveled with us and said, "We are the adversary press now." And that's why I say, the battles that changed America forever, divided America forever. You read Teddy White's chapter in the 1972 book, he talks about the war between Nixon and the press. It's two scorpions in a bottle.
Right.
I mean, our adversaries, Chris, were not Mike Mansfield, the majority leader, and Carl Albert or John McCormick, who were speakers of the House. They were gracious people, liberal Democrats, and you disagreed. Our adversaries were at the Post, they were at CBS, they were at the New York Times. And this is a fight to the finish, I think. One or the other is going to prevail in the public mind, or they're going to keep this up until one or the other prevails.
What keeps Donald Trump's base together, do you think, if it does?
The border security, and its manifestation of it is the wall. Secondly, is the economy. He's got to bring those manufacturing jobs back or bring jobs back. And the economy's got to do well. He's got to stay out of these wars that the neocons are dreaming up even now.
Nixon was mysterious enough, but I still don't know how to read. Does anybody know how to read Donald Trump as a man?
I mean, he's very much what you see is what you get. Because Nixon was so detested and despised, and because he fell, he's been basically written, a real villain of history. Then you take a look at the man's achievements. You know, he ended the Vietnam War. He created detente and the greatest arms limitation agreement in history. He opened up China. He brought all the troops and POWs home. He brought Egypt back into the Western camp. He was the first president behind the Iron Curtain. He built the EPA and OSHA. He ended the draft. You know, he got the 18-year-old vote through, indexed Social Security. Desegregated the whole South, the cooling of America. I mean, the list of achievements is endless. But all people, young people know about Nixon, if they know anything, is that he's the first president to resign and he went to China.
If all of that is true, Pat, and some of it is, it just underlines some very disquieting decline in our whole process.
It's time to realize that the country, America, is very close to a divorce with one of us with another. I mean, when Hillary Clinton, the Democratic candidate, can say our opponents are basket of deplorables, racist, sexist, homophobes, xenophobes, Islamophobes, bigots, and that's acceptable discourse. I mean, the point is Americans don't like each other very much. And we disagree with each other on every single matter of importance almost. There's deep and profound and angry disagreement. If a couple disagreed as deeply and broadly as we do, it would long ago have gotten a divorce.
Does Trump make it as a symptom? We know he's not a cause of all this, but does he illustrate, personify where we're at somehow?
Well, I think what Trump did is he saw where the trends were going and the two sides of this great divide, and he took up the leadership of the one side, and they responded to him as they did not respond at all to the Bush Republicans and the other Republican candidates, because they seemed to be the same old thing. And Trump seemed at least to really reach the people. I mean, he's got a very strong, powerful following out there. I realize it's a minority, but it's a huge minority. And they're very, very deeply loyal to him, and they put their hopes and trust in him. You know, I don't know what happens if people lose that. You have an intensity in terms of the hostility of the divided forces here that has almost reached the level of Saturday Night Massacre time in the Nixon White House. Even though, again, this is nothing comparable has happened. But there's no doubt the intensity and the hostility and the sense of almost semi-exhaustion as you wake up once a week or maybe more to some new blazing issue, that both sides, it's looking more and more like a fight to the death.
You want to forecast a date?
For when the Washington Post shuts down?
Pat Buchanan's memoir of the Nixon White House Wars is subtitled The Battles That Broke a President and Divided America Forever. Coming up, what Donald Trump has and hasn't learned from the Nixon record about taking on the press establishment and the intel bureaucracies. This is Open Source. Our guest, John Aloysius Farrell, the esteemed biographer of Tip O'Neill in the Congress and Clarence Darrow in the courtroom, has spiced the Nixon legend in a big one-volume life that's full of fresh memos and tapes and lines we'd almost forgotten. To David Frost, for example, when he spelled out the ultimate executive privilege, when the president does it, Nixon said, that means it is not illegal. John Farrell, page after page in this book, I scratch my head thinking, Donald Trump is Richard Nixon's son. What do you think?
I think that they do fish the same waters. The clip that you had with Trump talking about the silent majority is fascinating. Yesterday in his speech before the Coast Guard Academy, where he bemoaned the fact that he was picked on so badly, he used the phrase forgotten Americans, which was another phrase Nixon used. They both had the ability. I think Nixon had it because of a more dire upbringing, but they both had the ability to see the grievances in their audiences, see the fears, see the resentments, and pluck at them in a very successful political way. Trump may have learned it from watching Nixon. He certainly had advice from two of Nixon's more nefarious associates, Roy Cohn and Roger Stone. So he might have picked up a few tricks along the way.
I want to get back to Trump, but first a little bit about Nixon, and not to go as far as Pat Buchanan does, but except for 4 years of completely immoral and bootless and murderous war in Vietnam and the Christmas bombing after the war was over, you could almost say that Richard Nixon was a very effective and middle ground president.
Yeah. Let me give you one story that's in the book that I didn't know about and I think a lot of people don't know about. So Nixon gets elected in 1946 and he comes to Washington and he shows his red baiting immediately. He goes on a spy chase and he tracks down the red agent Alger Hiss. But he's also sent to Europe to inspect the damage after Europe and see whether or not there's a case to be made for the Marshall Plan. And back in his district in Southern California, which is then a rural conservative district, later became Orange County, They think this is pouring money down a socialist rat hole. They are so against it, and they write his backers write him a letter saying, "Do not fall for this." Nixon goes over there. He sees the desolation. He comes back, and he goes literally door to door in his district for 6 months, and he transformed public opinion on behalf of the Marshall Plan to the point where he not only wins the Republican nomination again, he wins the Democratic nomination for re-election and runs unopposed. Amazing story of Richard Nixon putting principle before expediency and putting his giving his constituents his judgment rather than just a knee-jerk obedience.
So how much Nixon can we see in Trump? And how much difference? There are sharp contrasts. I mean, to begin with, Trump was born to money, as you say. Nixon, eternally insecure about it. The dollar differences in these scandals is staggering. Nixon was dogged all his career by a $100,000 loan from Howard Hughes. Trump and the family enterprises raised $150 million 10 days ago in China for their real estate projects. I mean, this is...
I think there are two main comparisons with Trump, and the first is just the politics of grievances, what I call it. And the second is that there's been this amazing string of coincidences and then Trump's actions that mirror Nixon's actions in Watergate. But I really don't think that there's a case to be made that these are, you know, two sides of the same guy. Nixon was a scholar. He read books. He wrote books. He wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs magazine in 1967 predicting how the computer and cybernetic revolution was going to free Asia and European countries and bring down the fall of totalitarianism because the future was going to be for the nimble and the creative, and the big monolithic totalitarian countries couldn't stand that anymore. But the only big obstacle was that China would be sitting there with 800 million people and nuclear weapons. And so they had to be brought into the family of nations before this revolution took place. I mean, this is truly amazing, visionary stuff. You read it now and you go, holy crap, this guy was brilliant.
Did he think it for himself, or did some very smart...
No, he thought it himself. He lost in 60, and he lost in 62 to Pat Brown for governor of California, and he went out in what was called his wilderness years. And he traveled the world as an international lawyer for Pepsi-Cola. He met with U.S. diplomats and foreign ministers in all these countries when he was trying to sell them Pepsi. And he educated himself, and he read at night. He read Machiavelli. He read Nietzsche. He read histories of World War I and Churchill's history of World War II. Not like Trump at all in that regard.
Right. Speak of them as strategists, John. Both, I mean, Nixon's studied, as you say. Trump is intuitive.
Chris, show me one strategy that Donald Trump has exercised.
Are you kidding?
What?
I could win this thing. And I say totally intuitive. He couldn't write it out, but he did it. He bet on it.
I didn't think he ever thought he was going to win. I think he was the most surprised man in America when he was elected president, and maybe perhaps the most frightened. Certainly most unprepared.
Unprepared. Not even prepared at all. But in terms of reading the mood of the country, I mean, compared to the Clinton couple, for example, or the Washington Post.
He got elected.
That's what he said. And it wasn't an accident. He cast himself in a figure that people voted for.
Yeah, definitely. But he did it in an ugly way. I don't think it takes a great strategist to go around the country making fun of the disabled, making fun of slandering Mexicans, slandering the whole Islamic faith. You know, that's not a great strategist. Huey Long was that guy. That's a bully.
Speak of the
That's not Richard Nixon.
Okay. Well, duly noted. Speak of them as both extraordinarily unlikely successes in politics. These rather friendless characters, Nixon famously awkward, left-footed, you know, troubled-looking guy.
Part of the reason that he got in such trouble with the tapes was that all the other presidents had on and off buttons, and Bob Haldeman, his chief of staff, decided that Nixon was too much of a klutz and couldn't figure out the on-off button, and so he made it voice-activated. And so it ran always in the background. You listen to the tapes, you hear ice cubes tinkling, you hear the toilet flushing in the other room, you hear the stewards coming into the empty Oval Office whistling to themselves. It captured everything, and that's why it got him in such trouble. He forgot it was there.
John, hold it there for a moment. Your man Nixon had a long, intense two-way relationship with the FBI, which is a big part of the Trump saga now. Beverly Gage is an historian at Yale working on a new biography of J. Edgar Hoover, the founding G-Man. I asked her to explain how the FBI does and doesn't play politics then and now. There's a nugget in here, John, that I didn't find in your book.
Hoover and Nixon were very good friends, so they were political allies during sort of the height of the Red Scare and of McCarthyism, and they were very good social friends. You know, they wrote very affectionate notes to each other, and they actually, you know, thought of the other one as someone who could be trusted with various political secrets. But then once Nixon became president, he actually got in a few showdowns with Hoover over various things that Nixon really wanted the FBI to do, and Hoover refused. So, for instance, Nixon wanted a much more aggressive campaign against anti-war protesters and political dissidents of all sorts. And of course, the FBI was doing a lot of that already, but it wasn't enough for Nixon. And Hoover refused to do some of it. He thought that Nixon was going to get caught. I mean, the funny thing about Nixon in the end is that if you listen to the Nixon tapes, Hoover died in May of 1972. The Watergate break-in was June, and then Watergate played out for the next couple years. But as that saga unfolded, you can hear Nixon on the tapes saying, "This wouldn't be happening if Edgar were still alive. Edgar never would have let his agency leak in this way. He would have protected me. He would have come through for me, and we wouldn't be living in this political chaos." So even in the end, he still had quite a lot of posthumous faith in Hoover. But Hoover had very contested relationships, as you say, with lots of other political figures. He didn't like Bobby Kennedy. They were really at loggerheads. He and Lyndon Johnson got along incredibly well. In fact, Hoover did lots of political favors for Lyndon Johnson that I think are less well known than his showdowns with Nixon.
James Comey at the FBI kept on his desk a copy of J. Edgar Hoover's order to wiretap Martin Luther King, and of course they leaked everything they could about Dr. King. Comey, in preserving that record, may have seen himself as an anti-Hoover. What has changed, if anything?
I think it's fair to say you're right that Comey did see himself as something of an anti-Hoover, certainly in terms of the really over-the-top campaigns that the FBI conducted against figures like Martin Luther King. And those were not only investigations or surveillance operations, but they were real counterintelligence operations in which the FBI was sort of planting people within organizations to disrupt things, digging up dirt on people, sending threatening letters.
Known as character assassination, right?
Absolutely. And sometimes the press ran with it and sometimes they didn't. But so this kind of counterintelligence operation, I think, and the civil liberties abuses that went along with it are what that wiretap memo symbolizes. And I think also just the sense that if you believe that you're acting in some great cause, which we don't see in this King operation, but certainly Hoover believed he was doing, you can cross a lot of lines and you can commit a lot of pretty grave mistakes.
Beverly, think of Donald Trump's relationship with James Comey as an analog of Richard Nixon's with J. Edgar Hoover. What has Donald Trump got to learn and got to beware of here dealing with the FBI?
Well, I don't know that Donald Trump is going to learn anything from this, but I do think he may find that going to war against the intelligence agencies, going to war against the professional bureaucracies within the government is actually a pretty difficult thing to do, that though there is some level of political control over what we sometimes call sort of the administrative state, in many ways, they have real autonomy, real authority, and they are not often going to do things that they think are illegal. And they have lots of weapons at their disposal, particularly the intelligence agencies, and particularly in terms of the kinds of leaks that they can make. And we're already seeing that happen.
Do you want to comment on the culture of the modern FBI? Back in the day, you know, they were the guys in the snap-brim hats sitting in on the Communist Party meetings. And they would say to each other, "Booked any good Reds lately?" Describe them today in terms of the sorts of people that enter the FBI, still lawyers, most of them, young people from all over the country. What's their ideal?
The FBI has always had an identity, and I think that it still does, being somewhere between a kind of cohort of professionals, lawyers, as you say, during Hoover's day, lawyers and accountants. That's who joined the FBI. They wore their suits. Everybody knew what an FBI agent looked like because of his gray suit and, as you say, his snap brim hat. And on the other hand, they are cops. And so there is a real kind of law enforcement culture there. The FBI has always been professional, but a little more working class or middle class and sort of somewhere between elite professionals and street cops. And I think there's still something of that hybrid out there today.
Interesting. You wouldn't want to get in a fight with them.
I think that's safe to say.
That was Beverly Gage at Yale. I love it, John Farrell, that Richard Nixon thought in the aftermath that J. Edgar Hoover would have saved him, had he lived, from all that incriminating Watergate evidence.
It's very, very interesting, Chris, is that one of the reasons that we had the plumbers, that we had the break-ins, was that Nixon decided to bring all the dirty tricks in-house. Because J. Edgar Hoover, that sly old dog, could read the 60s and the political climate better than Richard Nixon. He was sort of like our old friend Tip O'Neill, who saw that things were changing and he came out against the war in Vietnam.
67, remember?
In 67. And Hoover did not want to go up onto the hill and raise his hand and talk about wiretaps and black bag jobs, the break-ins and the burglaries that the FBI used to do. And so when these proposals, the Houston plan and others, were put before him, he said no. He shot him down. And so that's why Nixon set up his special investigations unit inside the White House and brought in those brilliant gumshoes, Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy.
Could Nixon have been right that he said, Edgar, you know, deep six these tapes, will you, right now?
Sure, sure. One of the last things that Lyndon Johnson told Richard Nixon as they passed the baton was, he told him two things. He said, you know, keep the tape system because it's really helpful. And two, Edgar Hoover will be your best friend as president. I never could have governed without him.
I mean, it's a much, much more blatant obstruction of justice than what President Trump is in trouble for in telling James Comey to lay off his national security dude.
This gets under my craw because it has been 2 years since the Russians hacked the Democratic National Committee, and we don't know why they did it, who they worked with, or how it worked. The idea that this is sort of Watergate squeezed into a 3-month period is not correct, and you have the possible distortion of an American election, of our democracy. It's a big, big deal, big, serious thing. And here's the guy, Comey, who's supposed to be investigating it. And in the midst of conversations about his future running the Bureau, Donald Trump drops a couple of hints that, you know, maybe that future would be a lot brighter if he just laid off my good friend Michael Flynn, if he just backed off a little bit on the Russia probe. And when he doesn't, when Comey continues to be aggressive, he gets fired. I'm sorry. You know, I don't care what Pat Buchanan says. This is highly comparable to Nixon firing Archibald Cox, who the big difference then is we knew what the crime was and we knew what the evidence was and why Cox was trying to get it. We don't know for sure what the crime was, what the crime is, but certainly this was action that warranted a special counsel and I think warrants something like the 9/11 Commission to get the whole story out. This is, you know, this is unprecedented. An entire American presidential election interfered with, meddled with by a foreign power and an adversary. I mean, this is not just a little bit of Donald Trump being Donald Trump.
Come back to the fundamental Trump-Nixon contrast.
Sure.
I mean, Pat Buchanan was giving Nixon credit for the best White House staff of all time. Trump's is surely the weirdest, the fastest changing, the most, mysterious, odd.
I think one amazing thing is that if Trump went out today and hired a James Baker to run his White House and allowed him to instill some discipline there, especially with the president's own ever-running mouth, he could still, with both houses of Congress and his political skills, he could still, I think, have a very successful 8-year presidency. The biggest enemy that Donald Trump has is not what Pat says, you know, the press and the intellectuals and the intelligentsia. It's not. It's Donald Trump's mouth is his biggest enemy.
Buchanan is fascinating. Unless it's in your book, I'm getting the two of them mixed up now, but Haldeman running the meetings and with Kissinger at the other end of the table and everybody waiting their instructions from crew cut Bob.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a tight ship. And one of the problems was that Haldeman was overextended and he got tired of sitting in and listening to Nixon. If you listen to the White House tapes, so much of it is just Nixon, you know, chewing his cud over and over again. Or like Haldeman says, is like, you know how a dog sort of circles three or four times before he finally lies down? He said, that was Nixon coming to a decision and I had to sit through all of it. So he goes out and he gets from Massachusetts Charles Colson to come in to take part of that job over. And the difference was is that Haldeman had worked with Nixon for many years, and they had an understanding that when Nixon exploded and said something like, we're going to bomb Damascus, or we're going to fire the entire staff of the Laotian embassy, people like Bill Rogers and Haldeman, who had been around him, knew that this was just Nixon blowing off steam. Mm. Chuck Colson didn't, and Chuck Colson brought the dead mouse to the door.
We couldn't believe your line about the press is the enemy, the press is the enemy, the press is the enemy. And then our crack staff started looking around YouTube, and there it was. It's kind of amazing. John Farrell, it's wonderful to have you here. And don't go away. We're going to come back to you. But coming up, the omniscient lawyer and commentator Glenn Greenwald, who made the NSA leaker Edward Snowden famous, speaking about the risks of distraction in all of this Trump and Russia story. This is Open Source. Nobody watches our law, politics, and media more incisively than the free speech champion Glenn Greenwald, who lives most of the time now in Brazil. He broke the Edward Snowden story in The Guardian. 3 years ago, he co-founded The Intercept Online. I asked him this week over Skype to compare media cultures and the hazards of dissent between the Nixon 70s and 2017.
I mean, the person who has answered that question the best on some level is Daniel Ellsberg himself. He wrote this op-ed in the Washington Post in July of 2013, in which he basically said that even though he, Ellsberg, when he leaked the Pentagon Papers, chose to stay in the United States and to fight the charges against him, that he felt that Snowden made absolutely the right choice in leaving the country because the climate has so fundamentally changed. He said that, you know, when he was charged with leaking, he was out on bail. He was able to speak to the media. He was able to campaign publicly to defend himself. Now, if they had gotten their hands on Edward Snowden, they would have done the same thing to him what they did to Chelsea Manning, which is just disappeared him in a prison, rendered him incommunicado. The whole environment has become so much more oppressive. The Ellsberg case, the New York Times crusaded for the right to be free of government censorship and for the right to publish this material. They went to the U.S. Supreme Court and won. You saw this kind of very confrontational relationship between the government on the one hand and the press on the other that I think has almost entirely evaporated. And now you see the media much more as partners with various government agencies. Even in the age of Trump, they seem to be working very extensively with the intelligence community or various parts of the deep state who are opposed to Trump. But I think they're almost integrated into the government as opposed to adversarial to it. And that's been a major change.
Glenn Greenwald, you're a media sovereign yourself nowadays at The Intercept with Jeremy Scahill. What are you telling people? What do you want your next generations to remember that you told them about this era, 2017?
You know, there's so much talk about why has fake news become so contagious and why has faith in media institutions collapsed. The primary reason is that because the media is simultaneously afraid of those who wield great power and also operating in allegiance to whatever their favorite factions are, and people rightly no longer trust journalists to perform what they say their function is.
Glenn, in this glut of information that we're all suffering through 24 hours a day, all the time, strikes me there are two fascinating bells out there that always get people's attention. One is war. Trump hit Syria, their airfields, and suddenly he was popular in the media again. Fareed Zakaria said he became a president tonight. But the other thing is Russia. It's an amazing way of concentrating public minds, or the media thinks. And it may be Snowden's haven in Moscow, or Trump's record, hotel sex or otherwise, in Moscow, or loans, investments, detente with Putin or whatever. That's a scare word that still runs through our public culture. Explain it.
The more specific point that you raised, the second one about Russia, I think is even more significant and in a lot of ways more disturbing, because for many decades, Americans were trained to view Moscow, to view the Kremlin as this kind of existential enemy. It was the all-purpose villain, the uniter. And interestingly, a lot of times it was the right wing in the United States using it as a cudgel to beat the left wing over the head with, accusing them of being servants of the Kremlin or having allegiance to the Russians. And now in some ways, a lot of the kind of core propaganda has been preserved. It's still Moscow and the Russians and the Kremlin. But you see the Democrats now really using it to beat Trump over the head with. And it's a very dangerous game to exploit these tensions for domestic political gain. But I think you see that's exactly what's happening.
Do you ever feel that we're just in a game of distraction here? Keep our eye off the ball.
Definitely. The thing that amazes me the most, and I guess it's probably a critique more focused on the Democratic Party and maybe the media than anything else, but one of the things that I think has been really overlooked is that it wasn't just the 2016 presidential election that the Democrats kind of astoundingly lost, notwithstanding the fact that they outspent Donald Trump by 2-1, most unpopular candidate ever. They've kind of collapsed as a political force across the board. They've just lost touch with the vast bulk of American voters who don't regard the political system or either party in connection with their concerns or their interests. And you would think after that kind of political failure, there would be an attempt to focus on what is the political agenda that's resonating and what is failing? Why is there so much core dissatisfaction among the American populace? How has the government and the economy so radically failed the population? And those topics are virtually completely ignored in favor of these sort of scandals of the day, certainly the overarching one being Russia, but all the other ones about Trump's tweets or claims or whatever.
So give us two or three subjects for all of us as citizens to keep our eyes on.
Well, I mean, obviously there's this international trend that we saw in the UK with Brexit, that we see with the rise of far-right parties in European countries that have traditionally been quite progressive, and that we saw with the victory of Trump, where there's a huge amount of intense dissatisfaction with Western democracies, a perception that globalization and international institutions have failed them, that they're fundamentally unfair, and it's causing this serious backlash and a lot of instability that I don't think we're very equipped to deal with at all, because we don't spend much time trying to understand why it happened or what we could do to fix it. I also think that there is a pretty radical shift in lots of powers that were developed in the name of the war on terror that were used in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Somalia and Yemen are now being brought home in the name of security, paramilitarized police forces, the use of drones, the use of mass surveillance, all things that kind of got justified in the name of war fighting are now becoming domestic programs in a way that I think are transforming the nature of Western democracies.
That was Glenn Greenwald in Brazil. His dog's in the background this week. John Farrell, your turn again. There's a scoop in your new life of Richard Nixon. Can you give us the 3-minute version?
Sure. And it also has an analogy to Donald Trump. If it's true that the Trump campaign colluded with a foreign power, Nixon certainly did in 1968. And in doing so, he may have extended the Vietnam War. And in the book, I make the argument that this is far more reprehensible than anything he did in Watergate. And if you remember in 68, Lyndon Johnson dropped out of the race. He was not running for president again. And the Soviets, wanting to get Hubert Humphrey, his vice president, elected rather than Richard Nixon, began to pressure the North Vietnamese that summer of 1968 to come to a peace deal. And Lyndon Johnson was reluctant. He was skeptical. But he finally came along and decided that it was a real offer. It was a sincere offer. And he began to put it together when all of a sudden he got word from the FBI, from the intelligence agencies, that the Republican campaign, the Nixon campaign, was sabotaging this effort. And what happened is that the Nixon campaign sent Anna Chenault, who was a major fundraiser and official in the campaign, to talk to the South Vietnamese and tell them to boycott the talks, drag your feet, and you'll get a better deal if Nixon is elected. So there have been reports for a long time that this was true.
Also, that Henry Kissinger had a hand in it, no?
Henry Kissinger sent a warning from Paris, where he was sort of listening in on the Paris peace talks, to Nixon that something was up in the air. But I think actually, in fairness to Kissinger, his involvement in this has been exaggerated over the year. By the way that I read it.
Hmm. Where did you get this story, if I may ask?
The new one. Doing the old...
shoe leather.
It was not shoe leather. It's more turn every page. Iron butt and turn every page. But anyway, it had always been rumored that this had happened. Lyndon Johnson confronted Richard Nixon, and that's on a tape at the Johnson Library. But we've never been able to put the words into Richard Nixon's mouth, and he always denied it. He denied it to David Frost. He denied it to Johnson. And in turning over every page, I found this set of notes from Nixon to Haldeman in which he says, get Anna Chennault working on the South Vietnamese any way we can monkey wrench Johnson's peace initiative.
Whoa.
And because, I mean, you can't immediately make the leap that, all right, the war would have been ended in November 1968 because the North Vietnamese turned out to be such stubborn adversaries. But what a window into a person's soul that to get elected that he would gamble with what ended up being 20,000 more American lives and millions of Asian lives and the complete and total destruction of Cambodia, all the turmoil that Indochina went through in the succeeding 5-10 years. That's why I think it's worse than anything he did in Watergate.
John Farrell, how would you have framed the charge against him, the criminal charge, political charge, if you'd had the dope at the time?
There's a thing called the Logan Act, and it's only been applied once, and they never actually completed prosecution. But it basically was written by the founding fathers for just this exact kind of instance, saying that private individuals are it's against the law for them to interfere in the diplomacy of the United States, which is clearly what Nixon was doing.
Again, it's vastly worse than anything Mike Flynn was charged with, and the Russian ambassador.
This 1968, you know, we're going to be going through that 50th anniversary next year with the assassinations, the Tet Offensive, the riots in Chicago, Nixon's election, George Wallace, the rise of George Wallace.
The year everything happened.
Big year, yeah.
But and, you is know, the I wrote, moral I wrote, that, that all of today's distresses are, you know, not standard operating procedure, but have been going on for a long time? I mean, I draw a different, I must say, conclusion out of your book. The main one is that our politics turns men into monsters. I mean, it's a miserable, degrading business. Socrates was right about lifetime politicians, with one remarkable exception of your friend and mine, Tip O'Neill, who just got better and better as a human being all along. But this is unbelievably compromising business as it's practiced today.
Yeah, and it's amazing, too, if you think of those three Cold War – well, all the Cold War presidents showed some sign of cracking – some excesses. But if you look at Jack Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon, their personal behavior was so strange. And then you think about the pressure that they were under, 30,000 nuclear weapons pointed at countries pointed against each other around the entire civilization gone in 30 minutes. That was big stakes that today's presidents thankfully don't have to deal with. And parenthetically, I would say that part of the reason they don't have to deal with it is the contributions that Nixon made. Separating driving that wedge between the Soviet Union and Red China and bringing China out into the family of nations.
That's over my pay grade. But come back to Pat Buchanan's point that the country is sundered, that we're emotionally ready for a separation, if not a divorce, of two just abiding states of mind in this country, and not just, you know, the coasts and the heartland. Two kinds of people in this country that don't like each other anymore at all.
Yeah, I think it's a big danger. One of the last things that Nixon said to us before he left office was in that address at the East Room when he talked about, always remember others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them, and then you destroy yourself. That's something to think about. But as a ray of optimism, I think that Howard Dean is right. The other day he was on television. They asked him that same question, and he said, you know, it's going to end when the baby boomers finally die and take their argument to the grave. And then the millennials and the Xers will be able to run things with an entirely different set of values. And I hope he's right. I'm not sure that he is, but they seem to have a much stronger consensus about things like civil rights and human liberties and gender equality, and much more so than...
That's Howard Dean, you say.
Howard Dean said that, yeah.
Is Pat Buchanan overinvested in Nixon's view of America?
Pat Buchanan, I once asked him, Pat, just what is it that you want? And he said, I want America to be like it was when I was a kid. Well, sorry, Pat. You know, don't blame the intelligentsia for that. There's massive demographic changes, immigration brought on by your friends at the Chamber of Commerce who wanted cheap labor. There's lots of reasons America is not the way it was back when you were a kid growing up in Northwest Washington and getting in fights with the police. That's just, you know, time passes and you can't always have this nostalgia glow to take with you. You have to be willing to change with the times. Nixon was far better than that than Pat was.
I admire Pat Buchanan in so many ways. He's funny. He's also very, very smart. But I think he's still dealing with not getting the lure of John F. Kennedy as a young Irishman in the Capitol. He just went the other way, and he's been stuck out there forever, forever after. Before we're done, say goodnight to Roger Ailes. What's to be said about the man who created Fox News?
Well, you know, Nixon was in some ways the father of division. He was sort of a John the Baptist for McCarthyism. He was a red baiter. And then when he got in as president, he made the conscious decision in the fall of 1969 to send Spiro Agnew out, and then with the silent majority speech, to govern by division and by polarization. And so that legacy, I think, can be traced to Nixon. And Ailes was an advisor. I think Ailes was a technical advisor about television to Nixon.
More than technical. He was the anti-hero of the great selling of the president in 1968, the guy who staged those town halls with Bud Wilkinson answering the people's questions.
But he was still a technician. I think whatever he learned about bringing polarization to Fox News in later years, he probably drew from Nixon rather than the other way around.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. That doesn't get him off the hook, does it?
I don't think so. I think, you know, it's something we really have to work at. I voted for Obama because of that speech here in Boston where he talked about there's no red America, there's no blue America, there's just the United States of America. And I still think that's the prevailing feeling in America right now. People are very worried about the fact that we're divided. We have to learn to be able to have a give and take like you and I have had tonight and put our arms around each other's shoulders and go out and get a beer instead of going back and tweeting hateful things to each other.
We worship a mighty God in the blue states, and we have gay friends in the red states, too. Thank you, Barack Obama. John Farrell, I read the book almost word for word with huge pleasure and kind of discovery. People are also saying you did the totally impossible, which is to write a book about Nixon that didn't make him the Prince of Darkness or an altar boy either.
Yeah. Well, you know, 2/3 of the American people were not alive or living in the country when Nixon resigned, so I had to go back to basics. And in doing so, I found a story. The original working title was Richard Nixon, An American Tragedy, because he does have this sort of classic Greek. And this is not me talking. This is Elliot Richardson and Henry Kissinger said it back then, that he had this classic Greek character flaw.
And you still don't want to credit Donald Trump with a strategic
censor. You've worn me down, Chris.
About what was bothering this country last year.
He was very effective at tapping the same kind of grievances and resentments that Nixon did in his day. How's that?
Well, that's a wonderful concession.
And he lucked into having a miserably incompetent rival. I mean, she was awful. She was an awful candidate.
That's part of the story too, for sure. John Farrell, author of the new one-volume Life of Richard Nixon, and I have to say, your book on the late great Thomas P. O'Neill Jr. Is one of my favorite biographies, just a work of art, John, about a man who was really and truly a saint. Got better and better and better, and we remember him so fondly, especially because of your book.
Yeah, I was just out there at Boston College on this trip up here to Boston, dropping off some more of O'Neill's papers there, and I fell into that little nostalgic trip of my own thinking about Tip.
Yeah, he was a darling, as you would have said. Thank you, John Farrell. Thank you, Beverly Gage. Thank you, Glenn Greenwald and Pat Buchanan. Check out our website for more Nixonland extras, including one about Nixon's obsession with movies. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. Susan Coyne does our delightful illustrations on the website. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our dirty trickster. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source. Woo!